Bitcoin doesn't exist in isolation. Like, it's a product of history.
Yeah.
Like, and you can be angry at fiat currencies, or you can say thank you to fiat currencies, because without them, Satoshi would never have invented or discovered Bitcoin. Like, it's all a path dependence.
Just delighted to have with me today Atlas Hoddled, who I met at a Bush Bash. We have three of them a year in Australia, in regional parts of three of our eastern states. Welcome aboard to Bitcoin People, Atlas Hoddled.
Hi, Carrie, good to see you again.
It's lovely to see you again. You and I met for the first time at the last Bush Bash, and okay, tell me if I'm remembering this correctly. I think I was walking down for lunch and you were walking down in the same direction, and we fell into conversation and we landed at a pub and we had us, and there weren't many Bitcoiners around. They were all at the other pub. And so you and I got to have a quiet lunch together and we talked Bitcoin nonstop. Does that sound about right to you?
That's pretty much it. But we also toured a hospital museum beforehand.
That's right. That was amazing. Like, in this tiny little outback town with a population of, what do you reckon? Of a couple of thousand?
Yeah, 2,000, 3,000.
2,000 or 3,000. And they've got this, like, museum to medical equipment through the years. The dentist, I've got to say, the dentist seat kind of freaked me out.
The whole thing freaked me out.
The whole thing was a bit freaky. And they had, I remember all the different teas they had on the shelf, like all the little canisters of different teas that are like herbal remedial teas. I remember that really well. You know, just on a side note, my husband, son and I, the three of us, drove to Sydney recently, and on the way back we stopped somewhere, I can't remember where, and we came across a pen museum.
What?
A museum dedicated to pens throughout the ages, from quills through to biros through to and people donate from all over the world the unusual pens. It was so cool. I really liked it. And there was someone there who was like spending their retirement just opening it up for people every day.
That is interesting though, because it shows how technology changes over the years. And
I know, right? And you see it in every museum you go into, and it's like, you're right, every museum is a history of technology, really. Because if you go to a war museum, right, that's the history of war as seen through the eyes in many ways of technology and places, the interaction between human beings and technology and the technology that they've developed.
So, Carrie, what we need to set up is a money museum. And we can show, because the history of money is fascinating and it ends at Bitcoin at the moment. Like, it's the newest technology in money.
It's the newest technology in money. Do you reckon there is a money museum? There's got to be a money museum somewhere in the world.
Yeah, I did see on the Bitcoin Explorers. Have you seen those guys? They're an Italian couple and they travel around, and they were in Turkey. And they came across a museum of money, like notes. And there were jars filled with all these different currencies from around the world. So, yeah.
That's interesting. So that's money across space, not money across time. That's all the currencies from across the world without the actual history of the highs and lows of money, of centralized versus decentralized, of private versus state, of booms and busts, of, you know, ledger money through to commodity money through to fiat money through to digital money.
That's right. Well, you had the rhizestones of Yap, the island of Yap, and you had the seashells, which were money, and the glass beads. And then we went to gold. And so, that museum just had the notes, and they're actually a very recent they're not a very old monetary technology, are they? The paper note.
Oh, it's very recent, isn't it? And
Yeah.
I've just finished reading, or not quite finished reading, The Creature from Jekyll Island. And you know, I'm terrible with actually maintaining the dates in my head. So I've read it all, and then someone always expects me to remember the actual dates. But I think it's as well. I mean, was it happening before the Dutch East India Company?
I don't think so. I think that's probably when it started, when they started selling, I guess, bonds for those ships that were sailing overseas. You know, Lynn Alden's book, Broken Money, I think she goes into the history of money.
I've got it behind me and I've read it. And again, I don't remember the dates, and it'll all be there.
So I'm terrible with dates.
If we started a museum, you'd have to try and do it as objectively as possible. We could create an online museum.
That's true.
And then we could create like newspaper clippings from throughout the ages. And really, like, you could get, I mean, there's so much you could include in this. And then we could create, because I can't remember which part of Australia you're in, and you probably don't want to give that away. But maybe we can then create a physical location that's somewhere between the two of us.
Or I like your idea of having it online, because we're never going to be able to collect all that history, but we can collect photographs and articles, like you said, and just make an online museum of the history of monetary technology.
That's cool. So let's talk about that, because when you and I fell into conversation, and the reason I wanted to have you on the show was this just happened. We just started to explore, and there was a lot of kind of, yeah, I wonder about that. And, you know, like, there's just a lot of open-ended questions and ideas. So I wonder, what are the compartments of the museum that we would have? Obviously, you've got the history of money. You'd have to show evidence of all of the, you know, the beads and the cattle and the salt and the, you know, spices and everything that's been used. And then you'd need evidence for why did that technology fail? Like, glass beads worked up until Europeans came and invaded Africa and were able to make glass beads at a dime a dozen, you know, like and flood the market and buy what they wanted, including slaves. That's fundamentally the history of slavery, is the history of corruption of money. Because up until that moment, glass beads were rare. They started as kind of hyper-polished shells. And so so it's always about, my technology is superior to your technology. It's very rarely about brains. I mean, you're coming to the guns, germs, and steel ideas, aren't you? Which are, if I've got superior guns or superior capacity to create money or superior immune system, so the technology inside my body is stronger, or superior, you know, stronger metals, as it were, so capacity to build, create, engineer. And that's a lot to do with geography, like depending where you are in the world, horizontally or vertically, like latitudinally or longitudinally, will depend kind of. Have you read Guns, Germs, and Steel?
No, I haven't.
Right. So there are some technologies that are naturally available to you and, of course, give you a natural advantage. And there are limitations. I seem to remember it was something like, if your country is longer than it is wide, as it were, then you're very limited in terms of the climate you're going to get and the variety you're going to get if you're a wide but not very long country. That's my best way of describing it. Whereas if you're like tall and thin, you're more likely you might have, you know, it's cold in the north, you know, if you're up north, you're north of the equator.
Crossing the equator, yeah,
and then you've got a variety of agriculture and a variety of animals and a variety of plant life. And, you know, you've just got much greater diversity. And then you've got a diversity of human beings that are acclimatized, you know, to different climates and different environments. And when you get that into breeding, you also get a stronger immune system. So it's this whole thing. So it's the technology of the human body in parallel with the technology that they create and A, that they've got access to, like steel. Like if that's on the surface, then you start to dig down to see if there's something deeper. But if there's nothing on the surface, you don't know to dig, let alone where to dig. So much of it is just the luck of the draw, you know.
Yeah, what you're saying is reminding me of the conversation we had over lunch, actually, because we started talking about mega political theory. Do you remember that?
Yeah, vaguely. I remember it was a very big picture conversation, but I can't remember what we said. So what did we say?
Can I give the history of this idea?
Please.
Okay, so, you know, I was watching Flower World sort of happen in front of my eyes, and I was thinking to myself, like, what is going on here? So I asked myself the question, like, is this all incentive driven, or is this all driven by evil people, like, conspiring against us? And I'd been reading a lot of Bitcoin books, and one of them was the Sovereign Individual.
Yep.
And because those guys had predicted Bitcoin, have you read the Sovereign Individual?
I have, and not so long ago. Again, it's just up there behind me.
Oh, but I see it.
Yep.
Yeah. So I knew that they had predicted Bitcoin. So I knew that they must have had a fairly accurate framework for how the world works.
Yep.
So I went back to that book, and instead of just reading their content, I sort of read it to try to find out what their theories were, or how they had what they had used to write their book, like the ideas. And I found that they actually used this thing called mega political theory. And they have two previous books, actually, because they had predicted market crashes and things before. And they had used the same theory to predict that. So do you want me to explain what mega political theory is? Or
go for it. Go for it. The floor's all yours.
Okay. So I guess basically the idea is, so if we define politics as what people want, like, I guess, the decisions of humans. And so therefore, megapolitics is beyond that. So things that are more important than politicians' ideas or humans' ideas. And it turns out that there are four main categories of megapolitics. Like you were saying before, geography is one.
Yes.
For example, you mentioned the latitude and longitude. But, you know, you also have sort of elevation. So if you built your castle on top of a mountain, that no matter how powerful the king was who was trying to take down invade you, like, it didn't matter. Like, the hill was mega political. And then, like, in Guns, Germs, Steel, like, you've got another mega political theme is microorganisms, so diseases.
Yep.
So we saw that. We don't know if COVID was a natural thing, but, you know, if it was a real thing, there's no way we could have beaten it by wearing masks or, you know, telling people to stay in the house. Like, the disease doesn't care. It's just going to do what it does. Like, humans can't make decisions to stop it.
That's right.
And then third one is climate.
Yeah. Okay. Related to geography, but yeah.
Yep.
Well, so, related to topography, I guess. Yeah, which is what you were talking about before. Yeah.
Yeah. So, I don't know, like an example of that is during, I think it was World War II, when the Nazis were heading towards Russia.
Yeah.
And it became wintertime. They yep. just couldn't compete, like the cold weather. The Russians were much better at fighting in that, the weather, I guess.
They were familiar with it, and they had the right equipment, and they had the right clothing, and things like the German gun triggers were freezing, and the cables in their tanks were freezing. And just became non-operational. Yeah.
So, you know, the Nazis might have taken over the world if it wasn't for the weather. You know, like the weather yes. doesn't care about yes. the laws you make or, yeah. So these things are mega political. And then the fourth one and the most important one is technology. And that's an interesting one because with technology, humans have been able to make the other three less important because using technology, we can flatten mountains. You know, using technology, we can make vaccines against viruses. Wow. There's, you know, I don't. Yeah, that's a tricky subject. Let's not go into that.
Generally speaking, maybe not the ideal example right now, but broadly speaking, we understand what
that,
you're saying.
Before
we
that vaccine.
We can invent antibiotics and, overcome bacteria, for instance. Yeah.
Okay, that's a better one. Let's use that one. And then, if you look into the weather, like we have been modifying the weather, like we spray stuff in the sky. There are companies, Australian companies, which they're set up to change weather patterns for farmers. And so using technology, we've overcome the other three mega political things. So what we see today, like technology is such an important part of how the world is. Now, another name for megapolitical theory that they use in the book is the logic of violence.
Yep. This is going to tie into Jason Lowry's Soft War. Yeah, tell me.
Because we were talking about that at lunch as well, weren't we?
Probably. This is how bad my memory is. I don't remember the dates. I've read dozens of books now about the history of money, and I can't remember any of the dates or any of the detail. I get the general gist. I remember ideas, but I don't remember kind of dates, and I don't remember specifics of the conversation other than, oh, well, I had a great, really open, exploratory conversation with Atlas Huddled.
No worries. Okay, so can I explain how that is another term for megapolitics? So the logic of violence?
Yeah.
Okay, so if you look through history, the technological changes alter the logic of violence. And basically what that means is how hard is it to... Is it easier to steal from lots of people at once, or is it harder and you have to go to the individual to steal? That's basically the logic of violence. And through history, that seesaws backwards and forwards. So at the moment, it's easier for, let's say, the state to tax everybody, which I think is theft, and it's very easy for them because, you know, your employer actually will just pay the money to the government before it even hits your wallet. Like, you don't have a say in it. And then so as we get a better monetary technology, say Bitcoin, and you get paid straight in Bitcoin, the government will have to come and ask you for the money. Like, so the logic of violence keeps shifting depending on technological advances through history.
I probably asked you this question at the time and you probably answered it and I've forgotten that as well. But surely if you're being paid in Bitcoin, the organization that's paying you can still withhold a certain amount of it.
Yes, that's true.
on behalf of the government. So I'm not sure that it's a way around. Like, if we go to full Bitcoin economy, and I mean, as it is, there's capital gains tax, and because of KYC, they can see largely, for the most part, when you've sold it, obviously, if you've got some non-KYC or you've coin-joined or some other kind of privacy measure, that's one thing. But if you've bought on exchange and you sell on exchange, then you're up for capital gains tax. So I'm not quite sure how the theft has stopped, because the entire... And this is a point that I just actually uploaded recently, a podcast I did with Subi. And Zuby made a point about the fact that the whole point of America originally, part of the founding principles of America, was no tax. Like, the whole idea, the whole, that tea, you know, the war about the tea tax that was like the separation of America from England was all about, that was all about a tax that the British were putting on tea. And so the US started literally as a revolution against tax. And then not only did tax come in, not only did it become sort of one of the highest taxed countries in the world, but now people defend taxes. The culture has gone so far that if you are seen as avoiding tax, then you are seen as the thief, not the government for taking it from you, but you. And if you then go, which was the point Zuby was making, if you then go to Dubai in order to minimize your taxes, everybody sees that you're a cheat in some way, shape, or form, that you're just avoiding taxes. So the whole language, that language around tax evasion, is like, that's a dirty word, right? So that there's this cultural. So again, you don't need that many people at the top to be reinforcing something, because what happens is, and this is what we saw through COVID with the lockdowns and the masks and the mandates, was that you just tell the story at the top, you plant the seeds, and then you let the masses, your sheeple, do your dirty work for you and embed it. And so I'm really curious about to what degree, if Bitcoin isn't private, I can see how it can't be inflated. So that's a tax that it can, you know, that it can combat. But in terms of day-to-day tax, income tax, capital gains tax, death tax, council rates, you know, so on and so forth, they've still got the guns. They've still got the guns. They can still put you in jail for not paying.
Yeah, I think you hit the nail on the head. You're right. Bitcoin does protect you from the inflation tax.
Yeah.
But doesn't really protect you from direct income tax, does it?
No, that's right. Because they're two different guns at your head. There's the tax gun, which is we take money from you with a gun at your head. And then there's, you have to use fiat, that is by decree, meaning we have guns at your head to use our fiat. So but what it also can't do, well, I mean, this is the other thing, Ben. If you and I are transacting and I buy from you your whatever it is, you know, whatever service, your widget, your goat, your piece of technology, the phone you developed. So I buy that from you. I pay you in Bitcoin. That transaction is every bit as visible as a transaction using my credit card. So this is where going to a cashless society is such a nightmare, because at the moment, at least cash has some level of privacy about it. At least if I buy my groceries with cash, they don't know what I've bought with that money. They just know it's disappeared out of my bank account. With Bitcoin, that's all trackable, isn't it? Out of your wallet, in and out of your wallet, and into somebody else's wallet.
Only on the main chain. So.
Right. Yes. Okay. Good point.
So when you go to layer two, so Lightning, you gain more privacy, but it's not perfect privacy. And then if you go to a third layer, like a Chamin eCash, like Cashew or Fediment, that becomes private. That becomes like cash.
Right. Okay. Got it. Yes, 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 yes. And I was aware of that. I hadn't really stopped to think about that. You're absolutely right. So how does it minimize? Let's go to the conversation about then violence in other ways. Are there any other ways other than inflation violence? Is there any other violence it protects you from?
I think so. So it's a store of value. So if you are using your house, for example, as a store of value, and your government turns totalitarian, it's very difficult to leave your country with your house. Actually, it's impossible.
Yeah.
And then, so then you sell your house or fiat, and then it's very difficult to get your fiat out of the country if you've become a political enemy.
Yes.
But basically, the only way I know of is you'd have to convert it into Bitcoin, and then it exists in cyberspace. So it's already out of the country. It's not in any country. And then you have to cross a border with a password then, which is easier to hide than a house. Yeah.
This episode of Bitcoin People, proudly brought to you by BitRefill, your one-stop shop for living on Bitcoin and Lightning and building out the Bitcoin economy and this Bitcoin world we would all love to see come to fruition. They've got all the best gift cards like Amazon, Apple, Bunnings, Airbnb, Uber, and much more. They've got Coles and Woolies for your groceries, Bill Fairies to pay your bills, BP and Ampol for your petrol. You can do your hotel bookings or top up your phone credit or buy a gift or phone credit for a friend or loved one overseas. So check them out today, bitrefill.com, and remember to put Bitcoin People in the referral code for 10% Bitcoin back on your first purchase. Ultimately, and that's where flag theory comes in, and the fact that at least you have the capacity, you potentially have the capacity to leave. That's really
right.
It. You can vote with your feet and move to a more freedom-loving, lower tax environment, and you have to assume that there's going to be some countries out there like El Salvador, like Argentina now, that are going to be more freedom friendly. There will always be at least a couple of countries in the world if your government lets you out of your country.
That's right.
Yeah, because they still have border control and they can still stop you exactly as they did during COVID, getting out of your town, your city, let alone your country.
That's right. So, it's not a perfect solution, but it's in order to store your value or to protect your value, I think it does solve problems.
Yes, it does. I think, more and more I'm hearing people say, Saylor, Breedlove, just saying, look, it doesn't fix everything. It doesn't fix everything, but it makes a big difference because if you're, for that reason, then that's really the bottom line, is that I can get away and I can choose a different country. But I mean, at the moment, we could choose a different country and we don't. I mean, that's interesting, isn't it? It's not that easy to get up and move. If you're single, that's one thing. But to move when you've got a partner and children and they're established in school and they're happy, you would only make that move if you really had been identified as an enemy of the state and you have been personally persecuted. So it seems, I don't know, maybe that's just me as a woman, the likelihood of me being able to make my family do what I want seems laughable, literally. I'm always going to be the one who accommodates them and lives where they want to live and does what they want to do, and so maybe I'm seeing it too much through my own eyes, which is that I'm trapped by circumstances in many ways. And I say that, yeah, no, not just me. There'd be many families that, because they need to look after their elderly parents, you know? This is the thing. The government has got that on its side as well. Your emotional ties are to the people around you. And, you know, I mean, I brought this up in an interview where I was, you know, I was being interviewed in a podcast, and a Chinese dissident had come and spoken to us at our local libertarian meeting a little while ago, and he can't contact his family back in China at all. Big extended family. His mother died. Hugely important to be there for his mother's funeral from a family point of view as well as his own personal point of view. He was very close to his mother and he couldn't contact his family. He couldn't contact his family and he couldn't go back to China because he's on their radar. And, you know, that's really the choice you've got to make at that point in time. And so perhaps I'm thinking as a, I hate to say this and it's going to be controversial, but as a Jew, I've always thought about what's my escape plan. And the fact of the matter is, I'm not sure, other than the fact that I can get my money out of the country, there's still a lot of factors that make that difficult to do, either government intervention or emotional ties.
And, you know, you may not want to leave. You may want to stand your ground and fight, you know. You have to choose.
Yeah.
Which way you're going to go. But I think there are other technologies that are coming that will, I think we're heading towards more power being given to the individual. It's sort of like a trend that we're heading towards. Like I think with artificial intelligence, I don't believe they're going to be able to put a wall around that. I think we're all going to have it, our own personal AIs on our own computers. And that's going to put the world's knowledge in everyone's pocket, basically. And that's a empowerment to the individual. You know, if you have an artificial lawyer in your pocket, you're able to defend yourself against litigation. Like governments use laws to as a weapon against, us, you could say, or you know, you can use laws as a weapon. And so if you have and, you know, to study the law, it takes a long time. But if you had a specialist AI which knew the law, that would lower the cost to you having access to a lawyer, for example. And then there's 3D printing, which is going to put other technologies into the hands of the individual as well. Because you're going to be able to download a file of anything and print it. And
Give me an example of how you think that might be useful, other than 3D guns.
Offhand, I don't have another example. That's the best one. But
okay, because that's that is the issue. Through COVID, I really, for the first time ever, I understood why Americans feel so strongly about their gun rights.
Yeah,
and yet. They've never used them against the government. There's never been a people's army against the government because all that ever seems to happen is they're shooting each other and they don't use them against the government, which was the whole point of the First Amendment. And if they did, the government's got the army on their side. So how far would you get with it anyway? Like I can't, I know this is sounding, I'm putting up every question that comes up for me around, these are the questions that come up for me. They're not really so much about Bitcoin itself. It's about the revolution that Bitcoin represents. And I looked up, funnily enough, on AI Today. I asked for book recommendations around the issue, around cycles of centralization and decentralization.
Oh, really?
And it gave me about six book recommendations. Some were more modern than about the current political environment and the move towards decentralization, somewhere about the history of empires expanding too far with their central control, losing that control. Somewhere about more agrarian kind of economies. So I want to lay my hands on two or three of those because it's just an area that really interests me, and I've heard Mark Moss talk about, I bring this up all the time as well, it, for whatever reason, something gets stuck in my head and I just don't feel happy until I've got a resolution to it. And Mark Moss talks about three types of cycles, social and cultural, technological and economic. And part of the social and cultural is centralization and decentralization. And I've just found it really hard to find what's he basing that information on. Because when I asked AI, does that work in cycles like a certain number of years at a time? Like you can say there are 500-year economic cycles, for instance. You can say there's 84-year economic cycles, so the fourth turn of stuff, which is also a social and cultural cycle that's correlated with an economic cycle. There are technology cycles. There are technologies like world-changing technologies that come along every however many, you know, once a century or whatever it is. So, but there don't seem to be cycles per se in terms of numbers of years around centralization and decentralization. And the state is in a world of flux in as much as there's pockets of centralization and decentralization simultaneously. And, you know, microcosms and macrocosms, so you can have decentralization within a centralized, you can have centralized tax, but decentralized community, you know?
Mm.
So it's a very complex area.
So the authors of the Sovereign Individual.
Yep.
They track the cycles they're tracking are 500-year periods.
Yep. Yeah, and okay.
So they go from the year zero.
Yeah.
And basically in 500-year blocks, they sort of paint a picture of cycle switching from centralization to, well, they call it the logic of violence, going from centralized power to power to the individual. Well, yeah.
I need to reread it. It's been too long. It's got to be 3 years since I read it, and it just...
A lot of that information's in another book that they wrote prior as well.
What was that one?
I'd have to look it up.
That was The Great Reckoning.
Yeah, I think that's ago. It. Yeah, yep.
Yeah. I read that when I was in my 20s. Yeah, it's William Rees-Mogg and James Dale Davidson. Yeah,
that's it, yeah.
And it was those two. And I've got The Great Reckoning somewhere as well, I think, or maybe I got rid of it recently. I had a big cull.
Yeah, because they touch on things like the printing press, how that changed access to information. And they talk about like the knights being able, like the knights had a lot of power.
Yeah,
because one mounted armored knight was able to take on 50 peasants, and then
by having a horse and armor. Yep.
Yeah, and then the Catholic Church reined them in with chivalry, so it was sort of like a social attack on them, and took them under control. But the thing that really dismounted them was gunpowder, because once a peasant had a hunting rifle, they could just knock off a knight at 500 yards. So these are the sorts of things they talk about when these really big revolutionary technologies happen. They really alter the power structures.
Yeah, absolutely. And that's forever the case with weaponry in particular. And this is the stuff that, I mean, it goes back to how we defended ourselves as a species in evolution. So like in our ancestry. So, and you know, this is in the Sailor series, but he talks about earth, air, and water, really, and fire, earth, air, and water. So the idea of being able to use those elements in creative ways, because we don't have feathers and we don't have fur and we don't have fangs and we don't have claws and we don't have armor. We've got nothing useful really, except opposable thumbs and our capacity to coordinate together as a species, as a tribe. And so you know, obviously fire was enormously useful in terms of protecting ourselves at night, being able to see at night and build that social cohesion at night. The smoke kept away insects, that was also, as well as then cooking meat and the extra nutrition that comes from basically print. You've got water and the ability to transport heavy stuff on water downstream, including ourselves. So the use of water in that way, hydraulics. And then I can't remember what the corals and moats as a, but the air was what, it was really what you were just saying about having a gun at 500 yards or whatever it is that as soon as you can catapult something, as soon as you can not have to go into hand-to-hand combat, basically humans are going to be at a massive disadvantage. Humans are going to die if it's in hand-to-hand combat, end of story. So by getting that distance and catapulting something through the air and catching an animal between the eyes, then you've got hope. And so forever, from the very start, superior technology based on the elements is what gave us a fighting chance, is what gave us that violent edge. And it really is, it's the wielding of violence. Not that, I mean, to the degree that you call protection or defense also violence, you know, fire might have been protection. And you could also use it as attack rather than defense, because you can attack an animal with a fiery arrow, or you can simply burn the forest and cook the animals on the way, or they all run off the cliff and die at the bottom and you go down the bottom of the cliff and pick up their corpses. So it can be used for both attack and defense. And so really the history of humanity is the history of violence. And so it's not surprising that the most violent always rise to the top and take control. And so to whatever degree, Bitcoin can reduce some of that, you know, gives us a technological advantage, a capacity to push back, to fight back, because it's superior technology. Well, the beauty of Bitcoin is that's really what I'm saying.
Bitcoin's a non-violent technology, isn't it? It's
well, it's a defensive technology. We don't know if it can be used for attack, but it can be used for self-defense, to defend your you know, your money earned, to your stored wealth.
That's right. Well, it makes it more difficult to attack is another way of saying it. Like during the block-sized wars, I wasn't there, but from what I understand, the BTC Bitcoin has just had to sit back because it was more difficult to attack the network than it was to defend. It's a bit like sitting up in a castle.
Yeah.
Pre-gunpowder, and you had the knights just clashing against the walls, and you just were sitting inside, you know, eating a roast or something. So, yeah, I think looking at through the framework of violence, I don't see Bitcoin that way. Like, the way I use Bitcoin, it's really not violence at all. There's no violence. It's actually what it enables.
No, but it's a protection against. I guess what I'm saying is that, to the degree that superior violence always rises to the top of the hierarchy, Bitcoin is a defense against that. It gives us, for the first time, power, some power back to regular people.
Totally.
The way that the peasants, if they got hold of a gun, whilst they could use attack, it could also simply be defense for me to get on with my farming. you know?
Yeah.
And so it, not as an attack mechanism, not as a weapon. Yeah, okay. So so have you read Seb Bunny's book? Yeah, or heard anything about it?
Yeah, I'm in the middle of reading it, yeah.
Oh, are you? How is it? Because I read the half of the first iteration before it was fine-tuned, edited and re-edited and then published. So how are you finding that? Because I reckon that ties into this conversation because fundamentally his starting point is everything is downhill of money.
Oh, look, it's a brilliant book. So I'm concurrently reading Lynn Alden's Broken Money and then Seb Bunny's.
Yeah.
What's his called again? What's Seb's
The
book
Cost
called?
Of Money, isn't it? Or the hidden Cost of Money?
Hidden Cost of Money, yeah. And they're both brilliant books and they both take different angles at the same subject. And it's so interesting to sort of be reading them concurrently like that because Lynn Alden is so like clinical. She explains how the economic system works, like the, you know, the nuts and bolts. And then Seb Bunny is going from the cultural perspective, like what is actually the downhill effect of having broken money. So they're both really good books. Yeah, highly recommend both of them.
Absolutely. I want to read the Seb Bunny book because I know one of the things he really cares about in particular is the impact on families. What are some of the other impacts that he talks about there?
I don't feel like I could talk on it. I couldn't do it justice. Okay. You've just got to read the book.
It's all there.
Okay. It's all in the book. Yeah, sorry.
I was going to buy it from him, and then I think what was going to happen was Daz was going to bring a bunch of them in because the cost to get it in Australia was quite high, the physical copy. Are you reading an electronic? Are you reading it online?
Yeah, I got it on Kindle, yeah.
Are you reading an e-book?
Yeah, I have a Kindle.
Whereas I prefer to get physical books.
Yeah.
Yeah. Okay, then. Fair enough, too. So what's your... I've got like a historical question here and a futuristic question. I want to get an idea of what were your core values growing up and did they change? And how does Bitcoin tie into your core values?
Wow. What a question. What were my core values while I was growing up? Well,
yeah.
Okay. What comes to mind is, so my family were Labor voters. And so you kind of just go with that. So I think for a while I was a Labor voter just because my parents were. And then I kind of got sucked into all this, the world is ending because of carbon thing. And I became a Greens voter.
I did that in my 20s. Yep.
Oh, right. Okay. And now I'm politically homeless.
Yeah. Many of us are. Yeah. Many people across the world are because who represents my values. Come and join the Libertarian Party. we need all hands on deck. Yeah.
It's interesting. I was actually talking to someone the other day. They came from a Eastern European country. I can't remember which one. So they had lived through communism. I think they left in the 60s and immigrated here. And I was just having a discussion with them, and they were sort of defending communism in a way, and I was trying to I was rooting for the free market economy sort of thing. And then he emailed me and he said, oh, good, thanks for the conversation. And he said, don't get sucked into the neocon stuff. And I was like, oh, what is that? And so I looked it up. So neoconservatism is They're free market people, but they use war to defend it. So he, for some reason, right. like we had, he, I wasn't getting my point across because he thought I was a neocon, but I didn't even know what that was. But I thought that was interesting that all these ideologies are so close together. Like the neocons are for a free market, but they'll use war to defend it. Like that, it's kind of like what America does. They say they don't really have a free market economy, but they say they do. And then they pretend that they're defending the rights of the free market around the world, and they go in and blow everything up. So I don't know where I'm going with this, but I think Bitcoin...
Well, you were talking about being politically homeless and, you know, and then you find out there's all these variants of, you know, political, all these nuances of sort of political subcultures, as it were, or sub... subgroups, as it were. Talk me through underneath those. So those were your political leanings at different times. That's slightly different from the underlying values. What was it that you were valuing when you voted Labor? What was it that you were valuing when you voted Green? And what is it that you value now? If you had to name your top three values, the things that you most value, that are most important to you.
That's interesting. So the reason I voted for the Greens was I saw them defending the planet.
Yep.
And I didn't necessarily agree with everything. They were sort of the closest thing to what I cared about, because I went traveling. And I got interested in permaculture while I was traveling.
I think we talked about this. Yeah, because I really got into permaculture as well at one stage. Yeah.
Oh, really? Okay.
Yeah, yeah.
Oh, okay. So I came back to Australia and I did a couple of PDCs, or permaculture design certificates.
Yep.
Because I was disillusioned with, at the time I blamed money. I thought the money was evil in a way, like, and then big corporations were evil because they had all the money, which I see now as a flawed way of looking at it. But I didn't understand money back then, so I didn't realize you could have other types of money. Like, I was just blaming money for being evil, and if you wanted money, you were bad. So I was looking at permaculture as a way of dropping out and becoming self-sufficient.
Can I tell you a little sideline story?
Please, yeah.
Just because it's a funny little story. I did a short course called Discovering Horticulture. That wasn't the permaculture. I did some permaculture tours and things as well, but the short course that I did was in discovering horticulture. And one day a guy comes bursting into our room. We're waiting for our teacher, and a different teacher comes bursting into the room and goes, "Is this the disco whores?" Because it was discovering horticulture. And so on the timetable, it comes up as a disco whore. Anyway, sorry. Yeah. So I wanted to do permaculture, same reason as you. I was right into mud brick housing. I was right into dropping out of society. I didn't necessarily see money as evil, but I wanted, you know, they say that if you don't vote left when you're young, then you've got no heart. And if you don't vote right when you're old, you've got no brains. Like, I think that's a process we all have to go through as young people, is go, love us all, there is. And I didn't think money was evil. That wasn't the issue. Mine was more about, I just found the stress and the working pace of life really intense, because I was in a reasonably big job at the time, and I just found, I was in stockbroking, and I found the people and the culture to be really difficult to be around, and so I was forever fantasizing about dropping out in that way, and that's kind of what led me down that path. And I was also really into still am to some reasonable degree, actually. But I was kind of discovering spirituality, and it sort of all seemed to go hand in hand. So I absolutely get that as a, as a calling back in the day. So what moved you away from that? How did you make that differentiation for yourself? How did you come to see money differently over time? What moved you away from voting Greens, I guess?
Yeah, so permaculture led me there. Funny enough, I made friends with one of my permaculture teachers, and we were just hanging out one day, and he just off the cuff mentioned to me that he wished that he had have brought Bitcoin. And that was my introduction to Bitcoin. I was like, oh, okay, that's interesting. I sort of tucked that away in my mind. And then, yeah, later when I was at home and I had nothing to do, I just sort of, I thought to myself, what did he mean by that? And I pulled up the Bitcoin chart and was like, oh, I see what he means. He would have been rich. Yeah. So that's how I got into Bitcoin through permaculture, just that off the cuff comment by my teacher. And and then so I had brought a little bit of Bitcoin and I liked the idea of it. I wasn't sure if it was coming back. I thought, you know, maybe it's dead, but I'll just buy some anyway because I liked what Anthony Antonopoulos was saying about it. I thought the Internet of Money sounds pretty cool. But then fast forward to 2019 and the pandemic, and yeah, that was, I call it 2020 vision, in the year 2020, like everything sort of became easier to see.
Yeah.
And I started seeing the Greens.
Yeah, right.
All political parties saying get the vaccine, and everyone started saying all this crazy stuff, and yeah, that's when I became politically homeless, and then I had a lot of time.
That's true for me.
Yeah, I had a lot of time to read. Well, you know, I was going down the Bitcoin rabbit hole, and I changed my ideas about permaculture, because I think if you have the right money, so I think civilization is built on the division of labor. I think,
yep,
and that is, division of labor is made possible by money, and the better your money is, the purer the signal in the society is. Like the richer society becomes, the harder the money is. So I don't see becoming a specialist at living off the land by yourself is a very bad strategy for survival, yeah, as opposed to having a society where one person specializes in that, and then you can specialize in boot making, and another person specializes in knife making. So yeah, I think all the permaculture ideas are very good, but I became more focused on the money because I saw Bitcoin as being able to enable a better society as a whole that you didn't need to escape from.
Have you ever felt like the only Bitcoin enthusiast in your area? I certainly did. It is literally why I started the podcast, was just to meet other Bitcoiners. As it turns out, there was an easier way. I could have simply joined Orange Pill App. Orange Pill App is the ultimate social layer in Bitcoin. It was built by Bitcoiners for Bitcoiners. It is where you will find other Bitcoiners in your local area. It is where you will find events in your local area, and where you can also connect with merchants who take Bitcoin. So please hop on aboard, use the affiliate link below, and I'll look forward to seeing you there. So I want to, and I think that's, first of all, so many parallels between our two stories, it's kind of frightening. Although that probably isn't entirely unusual for people in Bitcoin. That 2020 was a real turning point for a lot of people, left and right. You know, there was a lot of people on the left who were appalled at the start, you know, like all the hippies were just appalled at the idea of the vax mandate. And it was a real, when I went to the protests in Melbourne on the streets, what a melting pot of individuals, all there for different reasons, because you had all the small business folk. Sorry, go on, yeah.
I was watching all that Melbourne stuff on the TV. That was crazy. Were you there during all that?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, yeah, absolutely. I got caught on video. I got on one of the, I think it was Rebel TV.
Yeah.
Was there with some cameras. But just briefly in the background, my, you know, microsecond of fame. There was a question brewing that I just wanted to ask you about all of that then. So you pivoted and it became, and that's right, it is about the division of labor. Oh, I know, the example I was going to use there is that I found out because I was really into the idea of maybe going overseas and doing some sort of, you know, with a not-for-profit organization and contributing my time and whatever. But I remember listening to a podcast and they worked through the maths of it and they went, you're better off making a lot of money and donating it to people who are already specialized in, you know, like in medical professionals over there and so on, and also building their own community from inside the community than going over and donating your time will be a waste in comparison, the same way that a bootmaker can't spend his time mining the steel to make the nails and growing the cow to make, you know, and tanning the leather, you know, he'd end up with one, you know, one set of boots at the end of it. So, okay, so that took you down the money track. So talk to me about what is, I ask a lot of people this question, but I think it's the question that gives me hope and that most interests me and that probably ties in to a large degree to Seb's book, with everything being downstream of money. What's your vision for the future? What do you imagine a hyper-Bitcoinized world could look like? I mean, first of all, what do you imagine a Bitcoin economy looks like? Do you imagine that being parallel? Do you imagine that being, taking over fiat economies? How do you imagine that playing out? And then what does society look like under those circumstances?
Wow, I love that question. No, I have to say I've got no idea. I mean, but it's a beautiful question. Like, I just want to sit and meditate on that and go, wow, what could it look like? Ah. But what I really like,
you know,
to do
it
is
strikes me as,
sorry, you go.
It strikes me as a second website. So we could have the museum, which is all the historical stuff, and then we can have the sci-fi version, which is what we imagine, right?
Yeah. Yeah.
And we can start, and you could almost start doing it as if it's all, as if it's a history of the moment when Bitcoin, the tipping point for Bitcoin, you know, the history of Bitcoin from inception and what it did to the world. So you could create a real history and then an imagined history. It'd be cool, two cool websites to have side by side.
So I do sort of have some idea of how it might play out. So basically, yep. I see a hard fork coming in society.
Yeah.
So at one point in time, I don't know how long in the future, you're going to have to make a decision of which version of society you want to be in. So you, one is the digital gulag, and the other one is extreme individual responsibility. And most people are going to choose the easier option, which is to just go into the gulag where you're taken care of, but you've lost all power over yourself. And the harder decision will be to take responsibility for yourself. Have you read, what's that book? Not 1984, it's the other one similar to it. Brave New World.
Brave New World.
Yeah, so in a Brave New World, there are people living
when I was a teenager.
Yeah, right. So in a Brave New World, there's a technologically advanced gulag society, but then they call it the outskirts or something, and where these people live primitively, but they're not part of the society. So I see it's sort of similar to that, but instead of being primitive, we'll be living in... Have you read, it's sort of like Galt's Gulch. Have you read Atlas Shrugged?
Yeah, yeah, yeah. That's also just back there. I just finished that really recently. Yeah.
Yeah, so Bitcoin is Galt's
Gulch.
So that
one is top of mind for me.
Yeah. Oh, you just read it. Oh, that's great. What did you think? Did you like it?
I loved it. I loved it. You can't help but impact it. There were some downsides. I mean, it was a piece of literature. It wasn't a perfect piece of literature. The sex scenes were weird. I don't know what happened to Ayn Rand when she was a kid, but those were some weird ass sex scenes. And like her idea of what's sexy and my idea of what's sexy are two very different things. And then the speeches felt a bit gratuitous. Like it just felt like the whole book was just an excuse to wedge in these, you know, these speeches from time to time. Yeah. But look, leaving that aside, in terms of the fundamental story, it's very impactful. And you certainly, again, I mean, it ties in. There must be something very deep in human nature that wants to imagine life outside of the society that you're living in, because that attractiveness of the John Galt, you know, utopia that he creates.
Yeah. And it might not even be that stark. Like there may be...
Sorry, say that again.
It may not end up quite as stark a choice as that, as between like a binary gulag and Bitcoin. And there could be a gradient in between. Like what I'd like to see is smaller states or city-states, like... Let's say there's a million different city-states to choose from, and they all offer a different governance structure, different currency. Like, if you really like communism, like, you can go and live under it, and you can choose that. And then if you really, you know, you can go to an El Salvador-style country, and I think we should be, you know, people... The problem is that we all don't want the same thing. So you can't have one... monolith state provide optimal conditions for everybody. So what we need to reduce the size of all states down so that it's kind of like the idea of America, where each state has different conditions and you can choose. Like here in Australia, each state
too homogenous.
Is very homogenous, yeah. So you don't really have a choice. So I'd like to see more choice.
Yeah.
That's I think that would be a good outcome, but then it'll be a free market between those. If you call them city states, they would be competing against each other for resources, and then you'd be like a competition to see which system worked the best. And I think you like a free, the freer the system is, that gives more freedom to the individual, I think is more productive. And I see that playing out as that will be the winning format, and then the others will have to adopt it to compete. So maybe that's how we get to hyper-Bitcoinization. I don't know.
Yeah, you've triggered so many different lines of thought. I mean, at one level, we've got that freedom now. And again, this is the conversation I was having with Zuby. If you don't want to pay tax, if you see that as oppression, then you can go to Dubai and live without tax. But you can't drink alcohol and you can't, you know, you can't criticize the government. So he said it's the way he thought of it is choose your level of authoritarianism.
Yeah.
I mean, you and I could go to El Salvador now. We could go to Argentina now and wait and see what's going to happen there. So there are different levels of freedom in society, and we do have freedom of movement to go to any of the above. I do think you're right about my electrician is just leaving. He's just finished. We're doing a bathroom reno at the moment, and he's literally just done the tail end of the day. And I'm just farewelling him because he's also a personal friend. So I always in those stories, see, there's always that. This is what makes me think there's some archetype that fits into this, because whenever you had, you're probably not of the age to remember, but there was a movie called Logan's Run years ago. Yeah. And there's always the mainstream society, which is utopian and up to a certain point, but there's always this kind of underbelly. And there's this, and I'm thinking Gattaca as well. What's the one? Was it also the one What's the one where they have the holiday and you win a holiday, but actually what happens is you're going to be murdered and cloned and something, I can't remember what, you know?
Yeah.
Some island they get taken away. I can't remember what that one was, but it's always that, isn't it? You know, which is what you're saying about Brave New World, is there's always a community on the outside that's not part of the utopia. I was talking about the movie Divergent the other day. Similar sort of thing. There's a, you know, small cluster of people always somewhere on the outskirts of town. Or, you know, need to get out of that main dome, the, you know, wherever the main society is, and there's some level of freedom outside of that. So it's almost like a deeply embedded narrative in humanity. And when you hear Saylor and Seyfertin talking about the, have you heard them talking about the five volumes of Rothbard, getting into the history basically of libertarianism and men fighting always for freedom and always losing whenever they've wanted hard money or freedom, that they always lose. And, you know, that's, I guess, my hope for Bitcoin, is that this is something that can't be touched. And I'm with you. I imagine a society that's built up separately, like the idea of getting all the people together, but, you know, plays on my mind, all the Bitcoiners, all the libertarians, all the freedom lovers, and having our own little country, you know? And you can imagine that country thriving, because that's a group of people who are all attracted to self-responsibility, looking after yourself and looking after others as well, but in a really kind of, there's an intelligent manner, in a thoughtful manner that doesn't require stealing and doesn't require violence. And so I imagine that as well. You would really need defenses, though, because the first thing that's going to happen is, if you've got a successful subculture or society or country somewhere, first thing is going to be that people want to steal your resources, your technology, and whatever you've got. So you've really got to advance your technology. You need a bunch of engineers in that society to formulate. Human nature is human nature. We see so much bickering amongst the Twitter community, just the Bitcoin Twitter community, and you go, we'd all be still at each other's throats, even if we had our own little community out there in the wilderness, you know? Because human nature is human nature is human nature. But I think it gives the opportunity, that's the thing, to be your best self. To get on with your passion project, the things you care about. If your money is increasing by 5% in value every year, and you've got enough of it that you can live on that 5% a year, then you can get on with what you care about and what you love. You can spend your life gardening and permaculturing, or you can spend your life designing and engineering, or you can spend your life, and then you've got, it's not coming from fear, it's coming from love. That's the difference.
Yeah, you hit the nail on the head. That's, we all need to work on ourselves so that we can, like, I think, have you come across Nozomi Hayase's work?
Hey, say that again. Which one?
Nozomi Hayase. Have you come across her work?
No.
I should look her up, because, she's written a lot of articles. And I think she had a podcast with Roger 9000 about Bitcoin is love.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, yeah.
And she just recently did a podcast with DJ from Discovering Bitcoin.
Yeah.
And, yeah, you got to listen to that, because she talks about, she used to be a journalist, and she used to be a, so she was fighting for equality and things like that through journalism, sort of an outward fight. And then her Bitcoin rabbit hole, she discovered that that was the wrong way to go, and she needs to work on herself. And we all need to work on ourselves in order to get along. Like, the struggle isn't external, the struggle is internal.
Yeah.
That leads back to the spirituality stuff. Yeah. Which I think Bitcoin will give people time to work on that. If you can claw back some of your time and break out of the hamster wheel, you can sort of have some freedom to think and
to create from a place of truth rather than a place of, I mean, this, I was going to say desperation. Necessity is the mother of invention, but not only. It's not the only mother of invention. Invention sometimes just comes from an idea, you know, that may not be a necessity, but just something you want to create, you know, just an idea that kind of comes to you in a moment's grace or a moment's silence. I've got to say, I've been thinking about that the more I focus on the problems, the more negative I get. Like if I'm constantly focused on the issues with the fiat system and then the kind of all the culture wars and all the rubbish that falls out of that, that's downstream of that, as Sip would say. Money. I find quite a bit at the moment. I need to pull because I'm not involved in the industry, so I'm not part of building out the infrastructure and the positivity around the vision, right? So I'm not involved in that vision on a daily basis, which is maybe why I'm finding, in lieu of the fact that I'm not involved in the vision, that I've been needing just since the beginning of the year, really. It wasn't specifically a New Year's resolution, but I just found myself withdrawing a little bit from Twitter, withdrawing even from reading so much more, like I'm reading the book When Money Dies, reading The Creature from Jekyll Island, reading The Private Life of Real Estate and Banking. And, you know, it's pretty bleak. And I don't think that's helpful because I feel like I need to be in my strongest, most positive, most optimistic self in order to come up with creative solutions, creative ideas. What is it that I can do to contribute? There are certain news stories that it's just not useful for me to be aware of because there's nothing I can do about it. Okay. There are some things I can do something about. The Libertarian Party is something I can be involved in and feel like I'm doing something about the political atmosphere. Bitcoin is something, or say this podcast is something I can feel I'm doing something about to make a difference and to educate the world or to bring different angles, maybe different ideas, draw out people maybe in a different way. And other than that, I need to be very, very quiet. I need to be really in my own little space. Really do. And I think it's actually the responsibility of the Bitcoin community to be quite self-reflective and quite centered in truth and love and peace.
Wow. I love that idea.
Because if we don't do that, what world are we creating? Then we just create more of the same.
That's so good. I love that.
With limitations. Limitations. I think Bitcoin puts limitations on the worst of human nature. I think that's it. But I think we could do better than that.
What you just said, something I've been thinking about. So in permaculture, there's a saying, the problem is the solution.
Right.
So in a permaculture context, you could say like horse manure is a problem if you've got too much of it, but it's also good for making compost. So, you know, you don't have a manure problem, you've got a compost shortage. Or, you know, if you've got lots of slugs in your garden, you don't have a slug problem, you've got a duck shortage. And I've sort of been applying that to Bitcoin, right? So I think what Satoshi did, because he saw the problem was money printing. And he's instead of saying that's the problem, he turned it into a solution. So now with Bitcoin, he developed something that benefits from them printing money. So instead of fighting against and printing money, you can just buy Bitcoin and then say print as much as you want. So,
like,
yeah, it's a, and then you can withdraw and then you can work on yourself. Like, you don't have to engage. Does that make sense?
Yeah. Yeah, that's right. I think that's right. The opportunity, that's really part of it, isn't it? The opportunity to disengage from the politics and the anger and the energy of the world, to not have to plug the politics in the office, for instance.
Yeah, I think Bitcoin allows us to do that once we, you know, through Bitcoin, we discover the problem and Bitcoin is the solution to the problem. And then it sort of all works out from there, I hope. Like, we still have work to do, but it sort of gives us a solution which doesn't require us fighting against the system. We can actually cheer them on and say, come on, print some more money. It just pumps our own bags, you know, like, it's a beautiful thing.
Well,
it really is. We've got the end of a fourth turning coming up. So we've only got, God willing, maybe six more years to this winter, you know, social and cultural winter, which started in around 2008. So we're really looking towards 2028, 29. I mean, it's only 5 years away, 2030, maybe 6 years away. Just got to get through this period. And meanwhile, you know, TikTok next block, and the new world is evolving underneath our noses, underneath our feet, out there in cyberspace, creating and shaping and molding us as individuals in the world without anybody even really particularly realizing that it is. It's an interesting way how it's interacting with human beings right now. I heard a great theory the other day that maybe if we're all in the matrix, the Bitcoin is a, this was Krista Edmonds from Access Tribe. She said, maybe this is a virus that's been released to free us.
Yeah, well, the way I see it, like, Bitcoin doesn't exist in isolation. Like, it's a product of history.
Yeah.
Like, and you can be angry at fiat currencies, or you can say thank you to fiat currencies, because without them, Satoshi would never have invented or discovered Bitcoin. Like, it's all a path dependence.
Oh, wow.
Without the problem,
there would never have been the solution. There would never have been the need for a solution.
Exactly. Like, it has to get bad before it can get better. And yeah, so if you start looking into Bitcoin, it's all dependent on, you know, the cryptography wars. There's lots of good books about the history of, well, what was happening with the cypherpunks before Bitcoin even came along, you know. So yeah, when you stop looking at Bitcoin in isolation and put it in the context of history, it almost looks like everything's just happening on time and on purpose.
Yeah, right. Maybe that's true. Maybe the world is unfolding exactly as it should be. Hard to imagine with the wars going on, but let's just not think about that right now and focus on the hope and focus on the things that we can do. Atlas Hoddled, it's been a pleasure having you on the program. Is there any final thoughts you'd like to throw into the ring?
No, I want to say thank you for having me on. It's been a great conversation. You're a very good interviewer. You ask good questions, so...
Oh, I talked way more with you than I normally do. Normally, I just ask questions and listen. You get me talking as well, and I like that it's a proper conversation. Will I see you at the next Bush Bash?
I hope so. Yeah, I hope so. Hope to see you there.
I hope so too.
And we've got.
I will look forward to it. We're going to have another lunch.
Yeah.
Be well, my friend. Thank you for joining me. All the best.
Thanks, Barry. Bye.
You know, what's a great reset look like? Okay, well, the Great Reset, something like that needs to happen, but I don't think the Great Reset looks like the Great Reset that people think about. The Great Reset has already started, and it's the Great Resetting, and that's Bitcoin, and it's slowly but surely. Nothing ever good happens fast. There's a reason why the saying early ripe, early rotten exists, because it does exist. And that's when you rush things, like when you have a really big boom, which is like you do a really big action, there's a very big reaction.